We are attentive to the implications of changes in the value of the dollar and will continue to formulate policy to guard against risks to our dual mandate to foster both maximum employment and price stability.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. Today is Monday, November 16th. I'm Alex Blumberg.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Today on the podcast... Yep, Law & Order, Planet Money style. We're going to do a recap of last week's not guilty verdict in one of the first big trials looking at Wall Street criminal-like behavior, or criminal behavior, as a possible cause of the meltdown.
Yeah, you might remember that two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers were facing criminal charges last week after the funds they managed blew up in the summer of 2007. Reporter Lisa Chow, who's been on the podcast before, she spent a lot of time at that trial, and she came in to tell us all about it.
But first, Alex, we have our Planet Money indicator, which is 1.4%.
That is the rate at which consumer spending increased last month. That's right, increased. We've been talking a lot about how numbers are decreasing around here. This is a good one. It's a better number than analysts were expecting.
I like it when numbers go up.
Yes, exactly.
Except for the unemployment rate.
Right, exactly.
I did my part. I bought my lunch today. All right, so on to today's podcast. As we said last week, two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, their names are Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tanin. They were acquitted in federal court of fraud charges. The government alleged that these two guys had broken the law by lying to investors.
Chiaffi and Tanin, they ran this fund, or a couple of funds, that invested mainly in subprime-related securities, CDOs and that sort of thing. And the funds were going great, making lots of money for their investors. But then, around the middle of 2007, the funds ran into trouble, and people in the funds started pulling their money out. And that's where the government said Chiaffi and Tanin broke the law.
A lot of the case had to do with redemptions, you know, when investors pull their money out of a fund. And prosecutors claimed that people were pulling their money out, but that Chiaffi and Tanin lied, told other people, don't worry, that's not happening, which is illegal.
The case was a big deal because it was the first time the government brought charges related to the subprime mortgage crisis and the ensuing financial downturn. And when the indictment against these two guys was first unsealed in June 2008, it seemed like the government had a pretty strong case. There were these damning emails the government had from Chiaffi and Tanin. One in particular they actually quoted in the press release, the feds did, when they unsealed the indictment. And it was from Matthew Tanin to Ralph Chiaffi, and it said, quote, "The subprime market looks pretty damn ugly. If we believe our internal modeling is anywhere close," all in caps, "to accurate, I think we should close the funds now. The reason for this is that if our modeling is correct, then the entire subprime market is toast." And then it goes on to say, "There is simply no way for us to make money ever." That was in the indictment. And I talked to WNYC reporter Lisa Chow, who was following the case from the beginning to the very end, about these emails and about how the government's case went wrong. And she said that that one line, which the government put in its indictment, it was taken from a longer email, a much longer email.
It's a four-page email written by Matthew Tanin from his Gmail account. So, you know, the government basically is trying to show that he went outside of the Bear Stearns system. That raises a little, you know, red flag. And he also sent this email from his Gmail account to Ralph Chiaffi's wife's personal email account.
I see.
Yes.
And so it sounds very damning. It seems like, yeah, he's basically admitting the government's case right there, that, like, we know it's really bad and we're trying to cover it up. So how did this not play in front of a jury? What happened?
How come this wasn't, yeah, a smoking gun that the government wanted? Well, I mean, if you read it closely, it's four pages. And the first page, the government called a love letter between one conspirator to another. It's a very kind of emotional, sentimental email. Uh-huh. And let me just read, before we get to the smoking gun,
sure,
part,
sure,
let me just read parts of this. And the defense read this in their closing to kind of humanize a little bit these two people. This is Matthew Tanin writing. He says, "Over the past 4 years, a lot has changed, and a lot has not. We have been very successful, measured in almost every conceivable way. We have raised a lot of money. We've made a lot of money. We've hired a lot of good people. But for me, most importantly, we have spent our time well. And time is the only thing in in this life, which one can't ever get back. And he goes on and he just talks about his feeling. And he's like, you know, I'm not sure how you're feeling right now deep down. I guess I'm not 100% sure how I'm feeling deep down either. But I think I'm feeling pretty damn good. I think I'm feeling this way because I have absolutely no doubt that that I've done the best possible job that I could have done. Mistakes, yep, I've made them. But they do not bother me as much as they did years ago. I've come to see that whatever my quote intelligence or quote abilities are, they are not substantially worse than any of the people we speak to, talk to, or read of. So, and he uses an expletive here.
F it.
All one can do is their best, and I have done this. And, you know, that first paragraph I read, Chafee's lawyer was reading that in his closing, and Tanin choked up. I mean, this is an email Tanin was writing, and he choked up, and you could see he was on the verge of tears. I mean, he put his hand to his mouth to kind of control himself. And there were moments where Chafee's choked up, too, because in their emails, they write a lot about their families and how at the end of the day, you know, they have their families and all that. So anyway, so that was...
So it's like if the government is trying to present this case of like these cold-hearted banksters out there lying to investors, that's the last thing the government wants to see is like this heartfelt email full of emotion, talking about your family, talking about how we tried our best and
daggone
it. We didn't quite make it every time, but we have no regrets and we did our best.
Right, yeah. Right. And then, okay, so that was part one. Part two is much more, and it's funny, he says, okay, part two. And he said, actually before he ends part one, he says, okay, put the Kleenex away. Part two is far less sentimental. That's him writing. Uh-huh. And then here he goes really into all of the options of what we can do with the funds. And, you know,
and this email is written in context. This is the thing, they know things are turning ugly in this market. They know that they're in trouble. Their funds are in trouble, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So let's kind of put us back in the timeline here. This email was written in it was written April 22nd, 2007, 3 days before a very important investor conference call, and that was this. There was this feeling that, okay, we're in some trouble. We just got this report, and this is the investment modeling report that he referred to in the email. We got this report. It's not looking... I'm reading this report, and this report really doesn't look very good for us. And so he kind of lays out his strategy, and he says, you know, that we have some important decisions to make, and then he just goes through these things. He's like, we could close the funds, and he gives reasons. He says the subprime market looks pretty damn ugly. CPR CDR, which is the model they're talking about, tells us we're looking at major write downs across the board. If we believe the runs Steve has been doing are anywhere close to accurate,
in other words, if we believe the model,
right, I think we should close the funds now. The reason for this is that if the model is correct, and this is what the defense is trying to point out, if everything is catched, and if, you know, of course they have this investor conference call coming up, so of course they're thinking about strategies. Like, what do? We just got this model, and Tanin is interpreting this model as really bad. You know, he's going through this option. If we believe this to be correct, then the entire subprime market is toast. And then he goes into this other scenario where then he says, you know, or we could be really aggressive. So, I mean, so that's what they're saying. It was a discussion point.
Right. It's sort of like when you see a movie review where it's just like one word and it's sort of like, awesome, you know, or whatever, and the reporter could have been writing, "Give me an awesome headache," you know.
Right,
but
right.
It's still, and it sounds like the government sort of did the same thing here. They cherry picked one little phrase from this email that sounds very damning, but if you put the whole email in context, it seems much less like a nefarious thing and more like a couple of prudent managers laying out all their options.
Right, right, and I think the jurors definitely picked up on that. One juror told me that, you know, you could find gotcha moments with anyone if you read select quotes from their emails. You know, I mean, he just felt it was an unfair tactic.
Wow.
And he actually pointed out, I mean, one juror that I spoke to pointed that out as saying, you know, if you pulled back the frame and read the entire email in context, it just, the government's argument didn't make sense.
Wow. And so what were they thinking? Why did they have anything else? Did they have any other sort of, was that their best shot?
Well, they also had this, I mean, basically they're, you know, and they kind of couched their argument consistently in this. We are not going after these guys because their hedge funds failed. We are going after these guys because they lied to investors. Right. So even if you disregard this particular email, another point that they reference consistently is in this investor conference call 3 days later after this email was written, Chafee said, I believe there's been a couple million of redemptions. Now that 9 seconds of an hour and a half investor conference call, the government claims was a lie.
Okay, now we have that clip right here, and we'll play that for you. So this is the clip you're talking about.
The big, you know, the questions we've been getting from a number of investors are, how do we look on a redemption subscription basis? The next big redemption date would be June 30th, and as of now, I believe we only have a couple million of redemptions for the June 30 date.
So that 9 seconds got debated over and over and over again?
Okay, so actually let me back up a little bit.
All right.
A few days before this investor conference call, they get a fax from their third largest investor who says he wants to pull out $57 million from the fund. So the government says the managers knew about this. They were already worried about redemptions, so it's kind of naivete to think that they didn't know about this $57 million redemption. I mean, they were worried about it. It was on the top of their minds. They hear from the third largest investor that he wants to pull $57 million out. So they knew about it. The defense says, yes, he knew about it, but they didn't know when the money was going to be pulled out. And right now they were talking about in the investor conference call, they're talking about a June 30th date. So the defense was saying, yes, they knew about the redemption, the $57 million redemption, but they didn't know when. And then there was this whole discussion about what's a redemption. If you put in a notice, is that really a redemption? Because investors always played this game.
So did that hedge fund eventually pull out $57 million or not?
They had two redemption notices, and I think they got part of their money out.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that 9 seconds where who won that discussion? Do you think the prosecution? I guess the defense won, right? Like the defense basically view prevailed that was not a lie by saying it's just a few million. He was basically saying.
Basically, the defense created enough doubt in the minds. I actually don't think that they necessarily won on that point, the defense. I think the prosecution won but did not win on a very critical element, which is, did these two men have the intent to defraud? Because I talked to one juror, and she said clearly they were withholding information. I mean, right. She even admitted, she's like, they were withholding information. If I were to talk to them right now, I would tell them, be more honest with your investors, be more upfront with your investors. But were they intending to defraud them is a completely different question. And I think that the jurors that I spoke to basically said they could not see the intent to defraud.
I mean, in terms of like, you know, this is one of the biggest Wall Street-centered crises in history that we've gone through. Clearly, there's many, many lawsuits. What does this mean for prosecutions going forward, for sort of seeking out wrongdoing going forward? What effect is this judgment going to have on that process?
You know, it's hard to say because, you know, I talked to a bunch of experts in securities law as well as just white-collar criminal law, former federal prosecutors and professors at Columbia Law School. And, you know, speaking to one former federal prosecutor, he says that so the fear by defense attorneys that we're going to go after the big fat cats on Wall Street if there were, you know, massive investor losses that people suffered is just unfounded.
Mm-hmm.
And that the presumption from the government that we're going to convict fat cats on Wall Street is also unfounded.
Just simply for being fat cats on Wall Street.
Right, yeah. Right. That you can't presume that. And one of the weaknesses in this case, this former federal prosecutor was telling me, is that they didn't have they didn't have someone cooperating with them. Basically, someone who could say, yes, on, you know, April 25th, we were sitting in a room and we decided to commit these crimes. And, you didn't have that. And so you just had a lot of circumstantial evidence that they were relying on. So this federal prosecutor said they're just going to have to make sure that their cases are really solid and airtight and that they're relying on, they're getting people cooperating with them who are basically admitting to the crimes.
Right. Right.
And they didn't have that.
Right.
So
And this case now, you were saying this case is not done, right? What is the next step of this? Like this case, the one in Brooklyn is done, but these guys are still have to face trial in on separate charges in Manhattan?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the SEC has its civil complaint against the two men, and there are many investors who have civil complaints against Matt Tanian and Ralph Chaffee, investor groups, but also banks, lenders who were lending them money right before it collapsed and felt that they were, defrauded. And let me just say very briefly, they are going after the two men in a very different way than the government. The government was focused on they lied, that securities fraud. The civil suits are really focusing on the actual investment strategy, that there was misrepresentation on how much subprime mortgages were the collateral to these hedge funds.
Right.
So they're really going after something much more kind of detailed and nuanced than—
And harder to explain to a jury, potentially.
Potentially much harder to explain. But of course, we know the bar is much lower for the civil guys. And the civil suits go after much more than Ralph and Matt. They go after them and their bosses and Bear Stearns. Mm-hmm. And because J.P. Morgan assumed all the liabilities, and J.P. Morgan also set aside something like $5 billion to pay out liabilities, that's why the civil litigants feel they have, they're dipping into a big pile of cash potentially.
Right.
And it's just interesting, like even just reading this, the details that came out, I mean, in this case, they're talking about Chaffee and his, five homes and the different, where that information did not come out in the government's case. But here they outlined very clearly how much money he made and, where his money was. And apparently he had an interest in Ferraris and was collecting.
Right. Yeah.
So,
it's so sort of the color that might have swung a jury
right.
a different way.
Right.
Had they, instead of just sort of like, I love you, man. Sort of rhetoric in their emails.
right.
So, Alex, it looks like these guys can't go on vacation just yet. They're going to have to be in the courtroom a little longer.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to be in the courtroom for a long time to come. But for the government, I think there's also a big question, which is do we try to bring any more criminal charges? And, I think what they were trying to do here is it seemed like was to keep it as simple as possible, just sort of make it about did they lie or not. And definitely that didn't work for the government. And so, we'll see what sort of cases they continue to bring and what sort of strategies they try to use.
Yeah, you don't get much better material than the subprime market is toast.
Exactly. And also, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, here are these people who are, they're in the most hated profession in America right now, probably. And at the end, I read some story in Bloomberg News that said that one of the jurors was quoted as saying that when she started, she thought they were guilty. But by the end, not only did she think they were not guilty, but she would have invested her own money with them if she had enough. So that's definitely not what you want if you're the prosecutor. So anyway, I think that wraps it up for us today. Please send us your comments, your pictures, your emails, your thoughts to planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thank you for listening.